From Buck Studio and Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, here's the number to call, 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, before we get to the phones, tell us some of the topics we'll talk over.
Yes, laughter reduces stress. Laughter may boost your immunity. Let's look at what laughter may actually do to your body to make you better. Very good, Tom. I love it. You think it's a funny study. Well, I've got news for you, buddy. No, then we'll talk about that. And vitamin E. Mm-hmm. Interesting research on super high doses of vitamin E. Vitamin E has been a dud in recent years, but this is a study that may show it has some value in Alzheimer's disease.
Oh, okay. What's our recipe?
Kentucky bourbon balls. And if you do not know what a bourbon ball is, stay tuned because you will listen to a dynamite recipe.
Yeah, they're good, too. 800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And to the phones we go now, Zorba, welcoming our first caller, a listener with us now in Eagle River, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, Zorba. Hi, Tom.
What's up?
Tom, sometimes I think of you as a PA, a physician's assistant.
you don't want to come to the doctor's office and see me.
Maybe we'll make it Zorba's Tom's assistant. The reason I'm calling is I have kind of what I would call a phenomenon or something off the wall. Every so often, I will hear a phone ring, one ring only. Almost, in fact, always, either during the night or first thing in the morning. Hmm. And the phone is right next to our bed. So, you know, the first time I heard it, naturally, you're instinctively ready to get up and answer. And then we discovered, or I did, that there was nothing there. Hmm. So it happened, never happens during the day, and it's a definite phone ring. And it also, I can hear it in the next room where there's another phone.
Go away.
First time I heard it, I thought, uh-oh, who died?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, in the middle of the night, you get a phone call. So there it is. I called the phone company, and they had no explanation for it because I thought, well, maybe I won't have to call Dr. Zorba. I'll just call the phone company.
Yeah, right.
That's right. I fix phones on the spot. I'm on the side.
I'm going to stick you with it nonetheless.
Yeah. You said we. This couldn't be your wife either playing a practical joke or trying to drive you crazy, could it?
That's not a drive. That's a putt.
That's very good.
She's not the type to do that, even if I suspected it.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you what this phenomena is. It's similar to a pocket call. Now, a pocket call has two meanings in our society. There are cell phones. One meaning is all of a sudden you didn't shut off your smartphone or you called somebody by accident. But the other is when the phone vibrates and their phone actually didn't vibrate. You didn't actually receive anything like that. And this turns out to be incredibly common. And it's, I don't know if, I wouldn't exactly call it an hallucination, but it's something that's similar to that. Let me give you a perfect example. I'm in Nepal. I'm in really totally away from everything. It's 2 weeks. I've been hiking either 4 hours a day or 10 hours a day. And I reach into my pocket because I feel like my cell phone is vibrating. I don't have a cell phone. I've got a pocket. That's all I have. And then for the rest of the day, I kept on reaching into the pocket, feeling that it was vibrating. I didn't receive a cell call for a month, basically, and I would feel this. And I discussed this with other people on the trip, and they had the same phenomena.
But hearing a phone ringing is a little different.
No, I have had the same phenomena with the phone because when I've been on call, I'm still a family doc, and at one point I was on call every other day, every third night, and every fourth night, and I would periodically wake up to hear the phone, and there was no phone ringing at all. And so I've kind of looked into this, and it's not really well described in the medical literature, but it is an anticipatory hallucination. That's what I would really phrase it. And it's a similar thing to the fact that here it is, you got to wake up at 6:30 in the morning, and you wake up at 6:20. You look at
clock. That happens to me all the time.
You look at your clock. You wake up at 6:20. You've been asleep, but you wake up before the clock goes off. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you wonder, gee, did I hear the clock? Why did I wake up at that moment? And the reality is we are paying attention sort of with a there's sort of part of our brain that is always paying attention to things. So it's not from the phone company. It's from your brain. And you're not going nuts, but that's what it is. So you want to know how to get rid of it, right?
Well, each time I think, well, that might be the last time. You know, you just don't know.
It won't be. It won't be the last time. The reality is I have not the foggiest idea how to get rid of it. That's exactly it. The reality is as long as you don't answer the phone and start talking, you're not going crazy.
I got you.
Thanks so much for your call.
You're welcome.
You know, it's amazing what is going on in your brain beneath the surface. You know, Freud talked about the unconscious and things that we do. And clearly, this is an unconscious phenomenon.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Oh, yeah. When I was on call one out of three nights, I would periodically hear the phone if I didn't get a call in the middle of the night. And I'm sure it was an anticipation of something going on.
I bet you this morning's thing was your body telling you that you didn't have your phone. And so that
That's right.
Why you reached in there.
Sure. I didn't have the phone and my body was saying, I usually do this.
Well, yeah.
So it's some other part of my brain that is reminding me I've got to carry this little gizmo. Yeah. You have a cell phone, right,
no.
Tim? A Luddite in our midst.
1-800-462-7413. Toll free. A line open now for you. And Zorba, a Norman, Oklahoma listener, is with us now. Hi.
Hi, Tom and Zorba. How are you?
Fine. How can we help?
Well, I have going crazy. I have a daughter that's about to be 9, and I have 4 kids altogether. This daughter is about to be 9 this coming weekend, and I would say for about the last 4 years, her behavior has gotten progressively worse. I keep thinking that maybe she'll, quote-unquote, grow out of it, and that has not happened. I actually took her to a LPC, a counselor, to try and get some insight into what's going on. And, of course, after just 2 visits, haven't gotten much help there, but was hoping that maybe Dr. Zorba had some advice for us in regard to diet or something where we could get things turned around here for us.
Not to be too personal, and you don't have to answer this, but can you give us any idea about what kind of behavior is going on?
Sure. I'm going to read a short list. I wanted to try and make sure I covered everything. She is 9 years old, and she's still extremely whiny. She talks in a whining voice no matter what. She still throws tantrums, still nags. She's very rowdy and rambunctious. She has trouble following written or verbal directions. She acts without regard to consequences, whether they're positive or negative. She has insomnia, trouble falling asleep, and wakes several times at night. Although she does have friends at school, she seems to have some really socially awkward behaviors to adults. She's a hypochondriac. She does have anger and aggression issues.
So she's got a whole bunch of things going on. So where did you go with her?
A licensed counselor. So okay. I don't feel like that is maybe...
Okay. I agree with you 100%.
Right.
Let me tell you what I think should be done. So first of all, she's got a whole list of behaviors. There are 2 things that pop up in my mind. One thing is, sounds a little bit almost like ADD, but it's clearly not ADD. I don't think it is ADD at all. I wouldn't think that is. And the other part that pops up is the depression anxiety scale. In other words, is this child very depressed or is this child very anxious about something? And the way to approach this is actually through a child psychiatrist, period. Now, I really like counselors. I work in a large medical group. We have a number of counselors. But the reality is their children like this need a full evaluation, I think, by a psychiatrist who can prescribe medications. And let me give you a perfect example of something. And once again, I don't know what your daughter has. I don't know if it's in the ADD spectrum, if it's in the almost Asperger spectrum, if it's in the depression anxiety spectrum. Saw a child the other day. And this is a 6-year-old child who's having lots of problems in school. So I deal with ADD all the time. The child had a diagnosis of ADD, and the mom said, I'd like to try some different medications. So we tried a couple of medications, and they failed. The child got worse. So the psychiatrist at the university called up, and they said, we want you to try a drug called clonidine. Now, clonidine is a drug that's used for high blood pressure, but it's also used in some other psychological situations, such as withdrawal from heroin and withdrawal from alcohol. And it's a very unusual drug. And I said, well, I've never used it before. The psychiatrist told me the dose. We gave the dose, teeny tiny dose to this child, added it to the ADD meds. Mother came in yesterday and I said, how's your child? And she said, splendid.
Oh.
Doing well, paying attention in school. Now, I bring this up for an important reason. I didn't know about clonidine. No. I had never heard about clonidine. I knew the ADD meds weren't working, and when it fails, I usually consult with someone like that. It's an unusual drug, and the psychiatrist was familiar with it. If you went to a counselor, a behavioral counselor who does not have the ability to prescribe and your child has not improved, you need a referral to a child psychiatrist, period. You know, that's what you have to do. And if you're in an insurance point of view and they say no, you say, wait a minute, I want to go see a child psychiatrist. And you want to see somebody who deals with children that age. Your child has a problem that we do not have a diagnosis for. That's what you need. That's what. There's no doubt about it. You're not going to be able to get your satisfaction, I think, from the behavioral group.
Right.
And you didn't. You went there and they said, well, you know, they threw up their heads. And sometimes you need that second opinion from somebody who's had more training. You need a diagnosis. Let us know what happens, please.
Okay, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You guys have a great day.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, we appreciate the call.
You know, one of the issues here is the fact that sometimes people get a referral and then they don't get the answer from the referral and they stop. And the fact is, sometimes you actually need a second opinion, and the first referral isn't right. Might be right 80% of the time, but not 100% of the time. And the second person will sometimes do it. And this is a child who absolutely needs to be attended to, because otherwise she is going to have lots of problems with this child for the rest of her life, maybe.
Yeah. Before our next call, Zorba, talk about laughing and lowering stress.
Yes, yes. Very interesting sort of article from the Mayo Clinic that looked at laughing. Now, I've got a nephew who just has a new baby, and the baby is 12 weeks old, and they sent us on an iPhone. Do you know what an iPhone is, Tom?
Yes, I know what an iPhone is.
iPhone. Sent us a little video. You know what a video is. Video on an iPhone.
Is, yeah.
Of their child laughing and giggling and smiling, and for whatever it is, humans love laughing. It's innate. And that's probably, among other things, has an evolutionary
A lot of humans don't laugh.
Well, babies laugh, young adults laugh. Well, I don't know if I would say a lot. I would say it's very rare to find a human that does not laugh. Now,
okay,
as you get older, it's
harder.
A lot
don't laugh very much.
No, but laughter inevitably feels good. When you laugh, you feel good.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think you can say, well, I laughed and I really didn't feel good, because that's a fake laugh, right? Where you say,
right. You know
what I mean? You go, ha, 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 but it's not a real laugh. Laughter by itself feels good. And according to this research, it does a number of things. It reduces stress. In other words, you have stress in your life. When you laugh, it has reduction of stress. That makes a little innate sense. But the number of studies have shown that it may actually activate the stress response by boosting your immunity, by boosting the endorphins in your body. It may actually ease pain, which of course is true. If you hit yourself with your hammer while you're doing something fun around the house, it's totally different than if you have something fall on your hand. And of course, it boosts your mood. So laughter is the best medicine.
Yeah. You know, at the top of the show, you mentioned the topic, and then I, you know, for effect,
I laughed. Yes, that's right.
It was a fake laugh.
Oh, yes, it wasn't a real laugh.
But I felt better, even though it was a fake laugh.
Well, that's very interesting.
I thought, hey, this is going to be a nice hour because I'm in a really good mood.
Isn't that interesting?
I made myself laugh.
But maybe that's part of what this study is showing, that, I don't want to say making yourself laugh, but putting yourself in situations with you where you laugh may make some evolutionary sense. There's a maxim that nothing makes sense in biology except by the light of evolution.
Mm-hmm.
So it made that laughter bonded us together, made us feel good, because when you laugh, often, especially with a real laugh, other people will laugh with you.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. I don't think I laugh enough. I have to laugh.
Well, you know what?
More.
You have to start watching sitcoms on TV and give up those shows. Stop the political shows, Tom, and start watching funny shows.
I think it's the people I hang out with.
You don't think they laugh enough? Your wife laughs a lot.
Yeah, my wife
laughs. Yeah, Monica laughs a lot. It's all those other friends that you have on the dog walk. Actually, dogs make you laugh, yeah, right? Yeah. Don't they? When you walk Cooper, don't you laugh?
Yeah.
Well, maybe that's the reason why we love dogs, because they make us laugh. They do goofy things and look at us, and you know, we believe they actually know what we're thinking.
That could be. 1-800-462-7413. And a Madison, Wisconsin listener with us now. Hi.
Hi, Dr. Zorba and Tom. Love the show.
Thanks. How can we help?
Yes. So I am calling because I have a pesky little problem with my nails. About 8 months ago, I noticed some indentations on two of my nails on my right hand. And I didn't think much of it. I just thought, oh, that's strange. And over time, watched it as my nails grew out. They became more dry and brittle and more of like a pitted nature. So it sort of concerned me, and I reached out to my physician. And my doctor said, well, don't worry about it. It's probably just from an injury. And I didn't really know. I couldn't pinpoint any injury at that time that might have caused it. So I was perplexed, but nonetheless, I just watched it. And now it's been 8 months later, mm-hmm. and it's starting to happen on my left hand on two of my nails.
Mm-hmm. So this is really a nail. Improved. Is it a thickening of the nail? Is it a discoloration of the nail?
It is not exactly a discoloration. It's just a dry brittleness. There's some a rough texture to the nail, mm-hmm. and it's not really growing as fast. It is sort of thinner, mm-hmm. so not thicker, mm-hmm. but thinner, and it will tear more easily.
One of the questions that I would have right away is whether or not you've got a fungal infection in your nail. That is a possibility.
Right.
And you can tell. Well, first of all, sometimes it's not easy to tell, but sometimes it is easy to tell. The doctor takes a scraping of the nail, or the PA or nurse practitioner will take a scraping of the nail, look at the nail under a plate, and look for a fungal infection. You can find it sometimes by just the scrapings in the nail. If that fails, sometimes we'll take a piece of the nail and actually see if it'll grow out a fungus. And if that's the case, there's a very good medication called Lamisil. L-A-M-I-S-I-L, 250 milligrams. You take it 1 week on, 3 weeks off over a 12-week period. And sometimes that can be very effective. Now, very effective means 80% effective. Which nail is this? Which nails bother you? These are...
Yeah, it's my middle finger on mm-hmm. my right hand and my thumb. And then on the left hand, what's starting is middle finger and index finger.
Yeah, you know, it just sounds fungal to me. And it sounds fungal to me. So I would do what's called a KOH stain, which looks for this fungal infection and see whether or not it's a fungus. And then I would try to culture it. And frankly, if that failed, I'd probably just try a course of the drugs to see. Now, if you cure the fungal infection, the nail actually doesn't change because the nail itself that you're looking at is dead. This will cure the fungal infection beneath the nail bed that you can't see. And so if it's a toenail, you don't necessarily see the full results sometimes for a month or two, but fingernails grow out quicker. So get a KOH stain.
Okay.
Keep us in the loop and let us know what happens.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate the call. Thanks. And before we take a quick break, Zorba, let's take a question from a listener all the way across the pond in Liechtenstein. She asks, I lived in Iran for 2 years in the mid-1970s, where tap water was not considered safe unless boiled. Consequently, we tended to drink sodas, which at that time were not sugar-free. When we came to the U.S., we found we had terrible dental problems, which were likely due to these sodas. True, we were drinking sugared sodas, but the dentist also indicated our tooth enamel had been compromised. So I think drinking carbonated beverages may be harmful, whether or not they are sugared, because the carbonation is acidic and can erode the enamel. What are your thoughts on this?
So we know that sugar is bad for the enamel, period. In other words, so you're drinking soda all the time. You know, you're not brushing your teeth. You're basically drinking it throughout the day. You've got sugar there. That's an issue. This has been an issue about carbonation for quite some time. And I've looked through the medical literature, and I think for the most part, I would say no. I don't think carbonation is the issue because we don't see that. Now, if you don't brush your teeth before you go to sleep at night and you're sleeping for 8 hours and you've had some soda or you drink that and it's sweet in the middle of the night, sits on your teeth, sugar is the most likely culprit. And I've traveled through Asia, very, very wild parts and remote parts of Asia. And one of the things that I found very interesting was that in the inner city, in the cities, I see people there with cavities, dental caries, as we call them, in their teeth, and they lost their teeth. And in the boonies, I don't see that at all. I see people with bright, shining teeth. And it was quite interesting because in some places, they don't really brush their teeth. They don't have access to toothpaste. It doesn't really exist. But they also don't have access to sugar. Sugar, sugar, sugar. That's the issue.
Have a healthy living question for Zorba? Just post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
A yummy recipe coming up. More of your calls, of course. Some more research to talk over. Our medical myth buster. The list goes on here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number, 1-800-462-7413. And we'll be back to the phones after our recipe. This one, Zorba, for Kentucky bourbon balls. Now, often, Carl, our producer, makes this recipe and brings it in.
That's right.
We don't have
bourbon balls in front of us.
That's,
but we do have bourbon.
No, we don't. You bring bourbon with you?
Hey, wait a minute. It's the, you know, I've always have a flask of bourbon with me, just in case you've got anything.
Of course. let's do
the recipe. And if you believe that, I'll tell you other stories. I can just imagine Penny, you want a drink, taking out a flask in my bag and drinking bourbon. It's not the issue. I am not a bourbon drinker. Mm-hmm. But bourbon balls are wonderful, and it sort of sounds, it sounds sort of sexy when you talk about it or when I think about it. But this...
They really taste good.
These were holiday treats.
Yeah.
The first recipes I ever used were from The Joy of Cooking, my favorite cookbook that I had when I was in college and a young adult, and we would have made with rum. And these are wonderful, wonderful things. And it's really good any time of year to be able to make something that people like that you can bring out that's a little nosh, a little something to enjoy. So let's talk about this. Okay, start out with 4 cups of ground vanilla wafers.
4 cups of ground vanilla wafers.
Now, guess how you do that.
How you grind them?
Yeah, you have to grind them. You could put them in a food processor.
Hit them with a hammer?
Just hit them with a hammer. You could do that. Put it in, hit them with a hammer. You could do a rolling pin.
Yeah.
There are lots of ways that you can do it. So you want to get 4 cups of ground vanilla wafers, 1 cup of ground pecans.
1 cup of ground pecans.
4 tablespoonfuls of your favorite cocoa.
4 big tea. Cocoa.
Now, to sweeten it, you can use 3 tablespoonfuls of honey or 3 tablespoonfuls of Cairo syrup, which is high fructose corn syrup, or you could probably use sugar, but I think I would use the liquid stuff because the sugar is not going to connect together.
Okay. That's 3 tablespoons honey or Cairo syrup.
That's right. 1 teaspoon of vanilla extract.
A little tea vanilla extract.
Now, if you want good vanilla extract, I've got a recipe for you. Mm-hmm. And we're going to post that on our website. Homemade Vanilla makes this recipe.
Okay.
Teaspoon of homemade vanilla. Mm-hmm. 1/2 cup of good quality bourbon.
1/2 cup of good quality bourbon. It says here, 4 Roses,
uh-huh.
Maker's Mark,
uh-huh.
Buffalo Trace.
Uh-huh.
I hardly ever drink anything.
How about Jim Beam?
I was going to say, whenever I drink bourbon, it's Jim Beam. That must be a really low quality
Jim
bourbon.
Jim Beam. Well, if you and I both drink it, we know it's not the top quality bourbon. There's no doubt about that. And if you want to know what kind of a bourbon to use, go to your local liquor store. I bet they'll give you some.
Give Carl a call, our producer.
He's the one that has this list of really good bourbon. Actually, we ought to put his cell phone on our website so people can just call him all the time and find out a good quality.
Yeah.
But a better quality bourbon is going to have a better taste. You don't want to use, what is it called, a rail, low quality, bottom shelf. You want a top shelf bourbon. It's on, on the top shelf because you can see it.
Okay.
1/2 cup of powdered sugar.
Half a cup powdered sugar.
So mix the ground vanilla wafers, ground pecans, and cocoa together. Then mix in the bourbon and the honey. Once again, it's going to be the honey or Cairo syrup because it's going to make it stick. And then, of course, after that, put in your 1 teaspoon of vanilla extract. Mm-hmm. Form it into balls, about 1 tablespoon full size. Roll it in the powdered sugar. If it's too dry, add a little more bourbon. You're done. That's it. You don't have to bake it. You don't have to cook it. You don't have to potchke with it. You don't have to do other stuff with it. You've got Kentucky bourbon balls. You can make it on the fly. Yeah. Bring it over to your friend's house. The next time they invite you over for dinner, you say, I'll bring dessert. They're going to be Kentucky bourbon balls.
Now, if you're a teetotaler, you won't want this, but you should know that these you're not going to get drunk by having a couple or three.
No. You're not going to get drunk. But if you're first of all, if you're an alcoholic, you don't want this.
Oh, yeah, right, of course.
I mean, if you're an alcoholic, the answer to all alcohol questions is no, no.
How do we find out how to make this if we weren't paying attention?
Gosh, if we weren't paying attention, I bet you could go to our Facebook page, look up Zorba Pastor on Your Health on our Facebook page, or you can go to our website at zorbapastor.org. You can look at us. You can see pictures of Tom on our Facebook or on our website. And you can look on our website for all our archive recipes. That's zorbapastor.org.
1-800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. And back to the phones we go now, Zorba. A listener with us in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hello there. Thank you so much for taking my call, gentlemen.
Sure. How can we help?
And by the way, this call is a perfect segue from the bourbon conversation.
Oh, okay. Love it. Love it.
I've had for about 6 or 7 years an issue with what can best be described as an alcohol intolerance. It started intermittently where I would have a cocktail and I would have a very violent reaction to it. And this would be like, you know, I was never a heavy drinker. This would be when I went out to dinner with my husband. And eventually the condition became greater occurrence and more violent.
What kind of reaction? Tell me what.
Well, it would take about 6 hours after having the cocktail, and I would wake up with loss of vertigo, violent vomiting, and unable to maintain consciousness. And the last cocktail that I had, the situation got so bad that I actually ended up in the emergency room.
Oh, what did they say in the emergency room? What was their diagnosis?
Well, it was really, quite frankly, embarrassing because I could tell by the way the physician was looking at me, the expression on his face, that he didn't believe that this reaction was from one cocktail.
Uh-huh. So you went to the emergency room. You had a reaction at that time. Did they have a diagnosis for what the reaction was? I mean, what, you know, did they give you anything in the ER? Did they hydrate you? What did they do?
They hydrated me, and they gave me an antiemetic.
And this occurred how long? About this occurs 4 to 6 hours.
The last occurrence was about 5 years ago, and I haven't had a drink since.
Yeah, well, certainly if it happened to me numerous times, I wouldn't either. No beer, no wine either?
No, any sort. I did little experiments with just small amounts of any sort of alcohol.
And you basically had the same kind of problem?
Yes, well, in my little experiments, I only took maybe 15 mils, and it was just enough to make me kind of queasy and give me a bit of a headache.
Sure, well,
you know. So I knew that this was not something
I wanted to do. It's not going to make going out to dinner a wonderful thing. Let's have a little alcohol, and I'll be queasy by the end of the night. Does not sound good. How about mouthwash? Do you use mouthwash at all?
I use a non-alcoholic mouthwash.
Okay, because mouthwash has a lot of alcohol. In fact, one of my patients was a very sad case, was an alcoholic, and she promised her daughter that she would never drink, never have hard liquor again, and she died from mouthwash. And in Alaska now, people are drinking Purell hand sanitizer, which is about 90% alcohol.
Oh, my goodness.
And getting drunk on Purell and having a whole bunch of complications because it's, you know, it's not the, it's terrible stuff to drink. You're clearly having some sort of an allergic reaction to alcohol. I mean, that's pretty clear. You stopped for 5 years. You tried giving small amounts. Small amount makes you queasy. It almost sounds like you were on Antabuse. Antabuse is a drug we give for alcoholics and makes them nauseous, makes them feel bad. Pretty much occurs right away. But there's something in your body that clearly is saying, I can't have alcohol. And it's almost like a food intolerance. And there may be no cure for this. You know, one of the things you can try if you want to try small amounts of alcohol so you can have a glass of wine or a beer. And by the way, does that bother you not to have any alcohol? Does it make a difference in your life?
Well, it does. You know, I especially wine.
Uh-huh.
I'm a pastry chef, and I had gone through the trouble of getting my Chef of Wine Arts certification.
So just
like a beginning sommelier. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. But I really enjoyed an occasional glass of wine.
Well, I would think a sommelier who cannot taste any wine because they get sick would not be exactly a recommendation for that at all. So you like wine. Well, one of the things you can try are things that we give for an exaggerated blush response with alcohol that sometimes work with people. And that would be taking 20 milligrams of Claritin. That's two over-the-counter generic Claritin tablets. Aspirin, one aspirin tablet. I would do a full-strength aspirin tablet. I would have that an hour before I would do my test, at least an hour, but it will last for probably 6 to 8 hours, but it won't kick in for about an hour. See if that makes a difference. And once again, I would do a little test on just a little 15 cc's, 15 mils, which is a very small amount of alcohol, and see if that would make a difference. Then I would see if it would make a difference with wine or beer or hard spirits. And if that was the case, then I would test it a little bit further. Try it and let us know.
Well, I'll have to screw up my courage a bit to try it, but thank you so
You're
much,
welcome.
Doctor.
You're welcome. You
appreciate
take care.
The call. Thanks. So sommelier is pastry chef?
Sommelier. No, no. They're the wine expert. It's not pastry. And it's say, well, you should have the red wine. It's not red and white, but it's the red wine that has this and that, and I would recommend pairing with it. So it's sort of the wine expert, and you have to go to school. You have to get training to actually be a sommelier. Now, where you get a job, I have no idea, because in Wisconsin, we have taverns.
Yeah.
Okay, mate, what kind of wine? Do you want red or white? Yeah. You know, that's about
I
as
love
far
those
as
expensive
go.
Restaurants. What I don't like is when they put the napkins on your lap for you.
Oh, you don't like that? Oh, come on. And then they say, how may I help you? And they smile.
Has that ever happened to you?
You know, it has happened to me. But let me tell you, it hasn't happened to me in years because I don't go out to those expensive restaurants anymore.
800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. Before we take a quick break, Zorba, let's take a question from a concerned listener, Elizabeth. She asks,
is she one of the police, by the way? Is she like a grammar police? Or
no, she has
she's
a question.
Not, she's not a
she
police, so
a
she's
question.
Just a questioner. I just want to know whether or not I've got to get, you know.
Oh, I always let you know ahead of time
if,
so
if
you
if
can
it's a
get
cop.
Your arm
okay,
up.
I get my arm up and stand at attention.
She asks, my 12-month-old daughter recently had her lead levels checked after I told the doctor that we live in an old house. Her lead levels came back safe, but the safe range was 0 to 4, and her levels were at 2. Sorry, I don't remember the units. The house has been completely remodeled, but I'm concerned about her having any lead in her system, and also where it may be coming from. Could it be the water? If so, would installing a filter help? And if that's true, can you recommend a certain type of filter? I looked at the store, and only some filters listed lead on the list of contaminants removed. Thanks for your help.
Well, perfectly good question. So is it coming from the pipes or is it coming from the paint that is in the house? So if we look at it from a pipe point of view, a lot of old pipes that went into the house had lead in them. And in fact, in the city of Madison, one of the things they're doing is replacing water mains going into the house because they had lead pipes or they used solder to do it. It's a huge project that's been going on for years to basically reduce the lead, getting it as close to zero as we can. So the pipes may be the issue. I can't tell you which filter to use if you want to. I would go to the EPA website. That's probably one place I would look. But you have in your community either a sanitarian, that's what they're called, or they have somebody in the Department of Hygiene that can tell you whether or not lead is common in the pipes going into the house. And they can also you can also bring the water in and measure it and see whether or not there's lead in there. That's the first place I'd look. I doubt if it's coming from the paint if the house is remodeled. Now, safe levels.
Yeah.
Generally recognized as safe means that on the whole, and that's what I say, 99% chance that the lead is not affecting your child. But if I had lead in my water and I was concerned, I would definitely go and get a filter. I would get one that filters it out, and I would get professional questions answered by my county.
Well, she's concerned that safe range is 0 to 4.
Right, and her child is 2.
Yeah.
Well, that is considered to be safe. In other words, from a point of view of where we know that lead causes problems, it causes problems over 4. Now, let's take a time. Let's say that you're a mother with a child and you see any lead, and this is lead that's checked now. Okay, so what's the lead level in 6 months?
Yeah.
Is that going to be 2 or is that going to be 4? So if I were a parent, I would say, where's this lead coming from? Mm-hmm. You know, it's not coming from gasoline. It's not coming from the environment. I might get checked myself, say, what's my lead level? Because maybe I've got a lead level of 2 or 4. And then I would search for what it is. It can be from paint chips in an old house. But the real issue is whether or not it's coming from the pipes. And many communities have decided that 0 is the safest level you can have and is close to 0. So I think it's safe. But what would I do? I'd find out where it was.
Yeah. Well, feel like you've been led astray? Post your question to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Some interesting research to talk over. That's coming up next. More of your calls, of course, on our medical Mythbuster 2, all right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number is 1-800-462-7413. But before our next call, Zorba, you've always been a little skeptical about vitamin E, but here's some research which will change your mind maybe?
Well, I'm still skeptical about E, but this is really interesting research in a specific disease situation. So first of all, what's the bottom line? Well, let's look at what actually went on. So there's a large group study that's going on in the VA system. And the VA system is in many ways a great system because it's a closed panel system. In other words, when you start with the VA, people who go to the VA tend to stay with the VA, Veteran Administration, they may go to their private doctors, but often information goes back and forth. So they've got a community of people, and they're looking at Alzheimer's disease. The study ran, this particular part of the study ran from 2007 to 2012. It's the largest, longest study ever done in people with mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease. So mild to moderate means it's not severe. In other words, so they can bathe, they can dress themselves, mm-hmm. but they've got cognitive difficulties. There were a total of more than 600 patients at 4 different VA medical centers who were involved. So it wasn't a lot of centers. It was a very good, well-designed study. And the researchers followed patients for an average for about 2.5 years, and they found those who took large mega doses of vitamin E, and we'll talk about those side effects, mm-hmm. but 2,000 international units of vitamin E had a slowing in the decline of their Alzheimer's. Didn't cure it, didn't stop it. It was slowing in a decline. And that slowing was roughly a 6-month slowing in their abilities where they had serious Alzheimer's where they could no longer bathe themselves and mm-hmm. feed themselves and so on. The ones on vitamin E had a 6-month grace period, if you will, where they didn't have it. And many of these patients were on Aricept and Nimantidine, which are other Alzheimer's drugs. And the vitamin E in this mega dose seemed to help it.
Hmm. So where do we go from here?
Well, that's an issue. Vitamin E did not prevent Alzheimer's disease. The studies have not panned that out. Vitamin E has not been good for heart disease. We've used 400 units generally to 800 units. And we know that high doses of E may have side effects in terms of bleeding disorders and others. But the real question is, are we using the wrong doses prior to this yeah. in our studies? And once again, we somehow have this belief in science, which I think is true, that if we knew when to start something, we might be able to prevent. And this sort of enters into this mainstream.
What about doubling that dose or tripling it?
Well, that's a good question. And that's where further research needs to be. But I think this issue shows that it's very, very encouraging for someone who is caring for somebody with Alzheimer's that 2,000 units of vitamin E a day may slow the progression, and it's time for doctors to take note and start treating.
1-800-462-7413 is our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. Back to the phones now, Zorba, as we welcome a listener in College Station, Texas. Hi.
Hello. My name is Switzer. sir. I live in Texas, and Switzer's actually a Catholic name. It's an Irish Catholic name. So don't assume I'm from Switzerland.
Okay, we won't. We won't assume that.
Anyway, here is my problem. Recently, I started having some knee muscle and joint discomfort periodically, and I'm 72, but I do 2 hours of exercise 3 times a week, and I've done this for 20 or 30 years, so I didn't expect this. Anyway, I started experiencing these problems, and I happened to have some pills that were left over from an anti-inflammatory prescription for a shoulder problem I had last year, and I took these pills once a day for 3 days, and my knee problems went away. Now, this prescription was by an orthopedic surgeon that said I needed shoulder surgery, but maybe it was anti-inflammation, and he gave me these pills, and I had the shoulder surgery anyway. But the medicine is called meloxicam, and it's 15 milligrams. I can take these for 3 days, and my knee and joint and groin problems go away.
Sure.
So I asked my internist about it a week or two ago, and he says, yeah, that's a prescription that you can take for arthritis. Well,
yeah.
I don't know that, and I'm still taking 3 times a day. I mean, 3 days in a row, and then I stopped taking them, but what else can I do?
Well, first of all, it's an anti-inflammatory drug.
Yeah.
Meloxicam is a good one. The FDA has actually said they all carry a little risk, little cardiovascular risk, small, little. We don't know if one is safer than another. It's a small risk. But then I always look at quality of life. Naproxen, over-the-counter Aleve, 2 tablets twice a day. Ibuprofen, 600 milligrams 3 times a day. Meloxicam, like you said, 15 milligrams once a day. Piroxicam, another one, 20 milligrams daily. These are all anti-inflammatories. And they're all fairly similar, but they're individual differences. Some like one better than another. Meloxicam, a number of people have been on it for years. Every single day, they feel better. It improves their quality of life. It allows them to exercise. You're 72. You know, your joints have a 40-year warranty. So you're now 32 years past your warranty stage. And the reality is that's where the aches and pains are coming from. Now, are they arthritis? Well, the answer is if we actually looked in the joint, you know, went with a scope, it may not show up on X-ray. You probably have arthritis. You know, getting to 72 and not having arthritis, pretty rare event. But in either case, anti-inflammatories allow you to function, reduce inflammation, and help with pain. I would say stay on it. And I don't think you have to stay on it just for 3 days. You could stay on it every day. Now, a little caveat here. The goal with anti-inflammatories is to take the minimum amount for the minimum amount of time. So you may discover 3 days on, a day or two off, works 3 days on, a day or two off. Figure out the minimal amount that you need to take, and I would take it because it allows you to move. Like you said, you exercise. Now, you didn't expect because you exercise that this would happen, right?
That's right.
Well, welcome to the real world. The exercise is no insurance that arthritis or joint pain is not going to happen. However, exercise has been shown to reduce the amount of pain that you get. So there's no doubt about it that you are getting benefit from the exercise. So keep up with it. Now, will your doctor give you a prescription for the meloxicam to take daily?
Yeah, he did, and he said 15 milligrams was too much, and he reduced that. I forgot what he reduced it to.
Yeah, how's it working on the lower dose?
Well, it seems to be working the same.
Yeah.
I didn't notice the difference.
And that's exactly what I would do. The minimal dose that works is the safest dose that works, especially as you get older and as your body does it. And you know what? You don't have to be saddled with the diagnosis of arthritis. That's really not essential. I think you could just say, the joints are getting a little bit old, the muscles are aching a little bit more, and I'm going to take this drug because it allows me to function and improves my quality of life. I take an anti-inflammatory every night because if I don't, I wake up with back pain. I've been doing it for years, and I will continue to do it because you know what? I'm allergic to pain.
Well, I'm annoyed with pain.
Ah, there you got it. That's exactly it. Thank you so much. Keep exercising. It's the key to a long, sweet life.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, time now for our medical mythbuster. This one comes to us from Jonathan in Galesville, Wisconsin. He writes, "Dear Dr. Zorba, since a food calorie is the amount of energy needed to raise 1 kilogram of water 1 degree Celsius, doesn't it stand to reason that hot food has more calories than the exact same food served cold? After all, calories fuel our metabolic process that heats our body, and if we eat hot food, we are detracting from the necessity of this metabolic process. So, should dieters eat cold food and drink cold beverages?
That's really, I love that as a concept. You know, whether you're drinking something cold or drinking something hot, it goes in your body, and your body converts it to 98.6, generally, if you're 98.6. So it has nothing to do with metabolism from dieters' point of view. In other words, if you're hotter and you stay hot, are you going to lose weight? Now, if you look back to the 20s, the 1920s, they used to put overweight people in those sort of steam trunks. Remember that from the old movies? Their head would be out, and they'd be in a steam... do you remember this at all?
Yeah, I guess so.
They would be in a steam trunk, and they would be there for maybe 30 minutes to 60 minutes. And the idea is you warmed up the rest of the body, you would increase the metabolism and lose weight. And you know what? It failed because you're not actually utilizing energy in your body. It has nothing to do with the utilization of energy. Sorry, the only way to lose weight is to eat less calories and exercise more. Neither hot nor cold will make a difference.
Have a myth you'd like Zorba to bite into? Just send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org or post it on Facebook.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number, 1-800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener in Iron River, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
Well, I have been a competitive ultra runner for about 20, 30 years, and I've always had issues, the nails falling off or athlete's foot or kind of cracking between the toes or infection, so they're kind of always in a state of kind of breaking down and healing.
Right,
and about
right.
15 years ago, my doc told me I should use Dial Gold soap on my feet.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And it's helped immensely. In fact, I mean, it's really has reduced the issues that I'm having.
It's great.
But what I'm having issues with now is the past couple of months I've heard about the active ingredient in the Dial Gold, the triclosan, and how the FDA is trying to ban it, and it claim that it causes endocrine issues and muscle contraction issues.
Well, the FDA looking at what is in there, the chemical that's in there. First of all, the soap is a drying soap. It's an antibacterial soap, so it's probably working as a drying soap as much as anything else. And you could go to Zest or Lifebuoy or one of the other, or Coast, one of the other drying soaps. But they all tend to contain the same sort of substance. And the FDA is now wondering if the substance is safe. That's sort of what the issue is. And I don't think that first of all, the FDA hasn't ruled on it. They're looking back and trying to say, what's the data on this? And second of all, the real issue is, are you using this on your entire body once a day or twice a day? So let's make an assumption, first of all. The FDA says, we don't think this is great to use. You could continue to use it on your foot, because your foot does not have a large surface area, and you could use other soap on the rest of your body, and you would be just fine. In other words, if this is the stuff that works to dry out and get rid of the problems in your foot, I would continue with it. But the FDA really hasn't, and we discussed this on the show a little while ago, the FDA hasn't really ruled on it. The question is, because we've become germophobes, is whether or not this is good for the environment and good for us on a whole. But that's a whole body issue. So if I were in your situation, what would I do? Well, if I knew the FDA was going to ban it, I would buy up a bunch of Dial soap, gold soap, and I would stockpile it in my house, and I would use it on my feet, and I'd probably buy a 20-year supply, because if I only use it on my feet, it wouldn't be that much at all. I don't think you run through any issues using it at this point. I take it you use it when you shower on your entire body, correct?
I do. Yeah, and I usually shower twice a day with work and training.
Yeah. You know, I have to tell you something very specific about Dial Gold soap. My Aunt Myrtle used Dial Gold soap in her house. My mother used Sweetheart soap, which they don't manufacture, and they both have different perfume smells. So whenever I use Dial Gold soap, I think of my Aunt Myrtle, who
of
is my favorite aunt. And I, in fact, have Dial Gold soap in the house, and I use it every night. I wash my hands, and I smell it, and my aunt's face comes into my vision.
How nice is that?
And I think, oh, it's wonderful, and I love it. And, in fact, that's why I use that particular soap at night. When my wife puts Dove soap, which is what she happens to like, in the bathroom, I now have a his and her bathroom bar. She can use Dove. I'm using Dial.
Huh.
So don't worry. Keep using it. The FDA at this time is mute. It's a good question, though, that they're asking.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I appreciate
it. You're welcome. Keep running.
Yeah, thank you so much for the call. And before we head out, Zorba, let's hear from the newest division of the Zorba Task Force, the Poetry Police. This week's...
Wait a second. The Poetry Police?
You'll get it.
Now, I've got the Grammar Police. You know, I mean, they're always right on top. But the Poetry?
Yep. Here it comes.
Okay.
This week's correction comes from an avid crossword puzzler, Linda. She writes, "Dear Tom and Zorba, just to let you know, Edna St. Vincent Millay did not write A Rose is a Rose is a Rose. This poem was first penned by Gertrude Stein."
Oh, by Gertrude Stein.
The line is from Stein's poem, Sacred Emily, written in 1913 and published in 1922 in Geography and Plays. "Rose is a rose is a rose is a rose. Loveliness extreme, extra gaiters, loveliness extreme, sweetest ice cream, pages, ages, page, ages, page, ages."
It's wonderful. You sound just like Garrison Keillor.
And that's a compliment?
Yes, it is.
If you think Zorba could use a dose of poetic justice, send your grievances along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org. You can do it on Facebook. And don't forget, you can also send us your favorite couplet. And if you do that, we will have a couplet contest to see whose couplet is best. And I promise to read it on the air.
Oh, my goodness.
And my favorite couplet is from Shakespeare. Did it at the wedding. My mistress is eyes are nothing like the sun. Full coral is far more red than her lips red. It's that Shakespeare sonnet that you might be familiar with. The couplet is, "And yet I think she is as fair as any she belied with false compare."
Nice. See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at zorbapastor.org. And remember, we are all over Facebook.
And you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen, and our technical director is Brad the Coal Barge Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll join us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0118Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at zorbapastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.